of propaganda. Accusing someone of having been a communist makes you the nut. The label communist is rather favorable, even a little jaunty. After Nixon was destroyed, Hiss rehabilitated, and Barbra Streisand and Robert Redford made the movie The Way We Were, there was warm nostalgia for communist traitors. They were hailed as martyrs, victims of McCarthyism. When Republican Senator Trent Lott uttered a single off-the-cuff remark in praise of Senator Strom Thurmond on his 100th birthday, there were urgent calls for Lott's resignation as Senate Majority Leader. 54 years earlier, Thurmond had run for president, and in a moment of bonhomie, Lott said the country would have been better off if Thurmond had won. The problem was, Thurmond had run as a segregationist. A huge brouhaha ensued. If we had gone to war with Iraq around the time of Lott's comment, no one would have noticed. The whole controversy was about one former Democrat praising another former Democrat for what had once been a Democratic policy. When asked who should replace Lott, Jesse Jackson said, "How about that Jaime Lieberman?" Thurmond's Dixiecrat Party was not the only extremist spinoff from the Democratic Party in 1948. In the apex of Moscow-directed subversion of U.S. politics, Henry Wallace, FDR's vice president and agriculture secretary, left the Democratic Party that same year to form the communist-dominated and Soviet-backed Progressive Party, excluding even the mildest criticism of Soviet aggression. Wallace met personally with KGB agents, and his platform, naturally, was supported by many of America's leading cultural celebrities. Just 2 years before Lott's remarks, a former Democratic senator from Iowa published a hagiographic work on Wallace's life titled American Dreamer. How about a book about a segregationist titled American Dreamer? The dust jacket on American Dreamer featured a nauseating statement of praise by Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy, saying the book deserved to be read by all who care about the American dream. Wallace's version of the American dream was communism every bit as much as Strom Thurmond's dream was segregation. Aren't dreams of murderous dictators, gulags, and death camps at least comparable in evil to segregated lunch counters? In 1999, the Clinton administration dedicated a room at the Agriculture Department to Wallace. At the dedication ceremony, former Democratic presidential candidate George McGovern gave a speech openly praising Wallace. McGovern fondly recalled that he himself had voted for Wallace and had run for president in 1972 on a similar platform with the help of a young Yale Law School graduate named Bill Clinton. Inasmuch as Trent Lott was in kindergarten in 1948, he did not vote for Thurmond. He did not run on a similar platform to the Dixiecrats. He did not write a jacket flap endorsement on a book that called a segregationist an American dreamer. But Lott was promptly removed as Senate Majority Leader. Liberals are utterly unabashed about their 70-year pattern of rooting for America's enemies. Praise for Stalinist stooges is blameless. Even the Stalinists themselves are viewed as merely mistaken but lovable idealists. It is a curious fact that the most ridiculed public figures in America in the 20th century have been those who posed the gravest threat to communism. Joseph McCarthy, J. Edgar Hoover, Richard Nixon, Whitaker Chambers, and Ronald Reagan. The left's shameful refusal to admit collaboration with one of the great totalitarian regimes of the last century, like their defense of Clinton, quickly transformed into a vicious slander campaign against those who bore witness against them. Caught absolutely red-handed, liberals started in with their typical bellicose counterattacks. McCarthy died censured and despised at 48 years old, his name a malediction. Hoover is maligned for having been a mad spymaster and is lyingly smeared as a crossdresser by people who admire crossdressers. Nixon was forced to resign the presidency in disgrace. Though persecuted in his day, Whitaker Chambers is not hated today only on a technicality. The MTV generation doesn't know who he is. They'd hate him too, but it would require research. By contrast, Ronald Reagan has prevailed over the left's campaign of lies because the American people do remember him, so far. Absurdly, liberals claim to hate J. Edgar Hoover because of their passion for civil liberties. The left's exquisite concern for civil liberties apparently did not extend to the Japanese. As President Franklin D. Roosevelt rounded up Japanese for the internment camps, liberals were awed by his genius. The National ACLU didn't make a peep. There was one lonely voice in the Roosevelt administration opposed to the Japanese internment, that of J. Edgar Hoover. The National ACLU gave J. Edgar Hoover an award for wartime vigilance during World War II. It was only when he turned his award-winning vigilance to Soviet spies that liberals thought Hoover was a beast. Liberals deemed it appropriate to throw Japanese citizens into internment camps on the basis of no evidence of subversive activity whatsoever. But it was outrageous for the FBI director to spy on high government officials taking their orders from Moscow. Liberals sheltered communists. Hoover was on to them, so they called him a fag. With precisely as much evidence as they had for McCarthy's alleged homosexuality, the left giddily gay-baited J. Edgar Hoover. While Hoover was alive, any journalist who could have proved he was gay would have won a Pulitzer Prize. But they couldn't get Hoover on a jaywalking charge. Only after he was dead did liberals go hog wild inventing lurid stories of Hoover showing up at Washington cocktail parties in drag, perhaps not recognizing their own Pamela Harriman. Liberals wouldn't take their revenge on Richard Nixon for 20 years, but when they did, it was spectacular. The left's consuming hatred for Nixon is incomprehensible, disassociated from his anti-communism. Carl Bernstein, the Washington Post reporter who, along with Bob Woodward, saved the world by exposing Watergate, said he grew up thinking of Soviet spy Ethel Rosenberg as a Jewish Madonna. After Nixon exposed Hiss and his Democrat patrons, liberals would not rest until he was ruined. This is the true story of Watergate. Except for his proud red-baiting days in the 50s, Nixon was the sort of politician normally cited admiringly in the New York Times as a moderate Republican. Nixon imposed wage and price controls, established relations with Communist China, engaged in détente with the Soviet Union, created the Environmental Protection Agency, expanded the federal food stamp program, hired Henry Kissinger, and put Harry Blackmun on the Supreme Court. Many of the government regulations and spending programs that would be cut by Ronald Reagan a decade later were, as the New York Times admitted, products of the Nixon administration. The gravamen of Watergate were dirty tricks as commonplace as lobbyists in Washington. Consider the hysteria-inducing question, what did he know and when did he know it? The it was wiretapping and spying, activities with a long and illustrious pedigree in Washington. Historian Paul Johnson provides a short history of presidential skullduggery in his book Modern Times. President Roosevelt pioneered covert surveillance in the Oval Office, building a secret room off the office where stenographers would transcribe all his conversations. He engaged in mad surveillance, even secretly listening in on his own wife in her hotel room. FDR tapped the phones of unfriendly members of the press as well as political opponents, such as John Lewis of the United Mine Workers. President Kennedy and his brother Robert, the Attorney General, arranged for Martin Luther King's adulterous liaisons to be wiretapped, and the tapes played for reporters. They plotted against right-wing radio and TV stations. Robert Kennedy retaliated against executives of U.S. Steel who had defied his brother's policies by raiding their homes at dawn. President Johnson took surveillance of his enemies to a new level, using secret government files, the Internal Revenue Service, and other executive devices to protect himself against exposure in the Bobby Baker scandal of 1963, potentially the biggest scandal since Teapot Dome. Johnson bugged Goldwater in 1964. NBC TV bugged the Democratic Party headquarters in 1968. The press blithely covered up scandalous behavior of presidents they liked. These constitutionally protected guardians of the truth lied to the public about Kennedy's pill-popping and pathological womanizing. JFK kept a secret apartment for his mistress, one whom he shared with a gangster. This was never reported. President Johnson's prodigious bribe-taking as vice president was hidden from the public. Historian Paul Johnson concludes this shameful record with the fabulous understatement, Nixon enjoyed no such forbearance from the media. The media detested Nixon, and his popularity made them loathe him even more. In 1972, President Nixon ran for re-election against the media's dream candidate, George McGovern. As Nixon said, the Eastern establishment media finally has a candidate who almost totally shares their views. Amnesty, pot, abortion, confiscation of wealth, unless it is theirs, massive increases in welfare, unilateral disarmament, reduction of our defenses, and surrender in Vietnam. Now, he said, we'd see what the American people think. McGovern was smashed in a 49-state landslide for Nixon. Despite giddy assertions in the society pages, Nixon had no enemies list. It existed only in the fantasy lives of liberals. Three Nixon staffers created a so-called enemies list, never requested or seen by Nixon. The very idea that Nixon needed a list to know who his enemies were is preposterous. Nixon's enemies were powerful, and he was hunted. And yet, even when ruthlessly destroying people, liberals must pretend to be the ones who are oppressed. Nixon exposed Alger Hiss. He beat media darling McGovern in a 49-state landslide, and he was winning the war in Vietnam. Most egregiously, Nixon spied on the anti-war felon Daniel Ellsberg. Ellsberg stole classified material from the State Department and gave it to a traitorous press in hopes of undermining the Vietnam War. Nixon had no self-interest in preventing the publication of the Pentagon Papers. They covered his predecessor's administrations, not his. But unlike liberals, Nixon thought it would be bad if communists swept through Southeast Asia. For stealing the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg was the left's most storied hero since Alger Hiss. Nixon's associates, the plumbers, broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to get dirt on him, a more noble cause, one might add, than the Kennedy brothers' skullduggery against Martin Luther King. Nixon's spying on Ellsberg would not stand. From Hiss to Ellsberg, Nixon would not give traitors a break. Watergate was the left's final revenge. Liberals remember nothing but their resentments. Just as Watergate was payback for Hiss, Bill Clinton was payback for Reagan. When Reagan won the Cold War, he won a 50-year argument with liberals. Liberals had been on the wrong side of the Cold War for most of the 20th century. They were wrong about Hiss, wrong about communist infiltration of the government in the 40s and 50s, wrong about China, and wrong about Reagan. Liberal moaning about indigenous peoples and inevitable revolutions was finally exposed as the nonsense it always was. Even their extravagant plans for a government takeover of every American industry suffered a bit of a setback with the fall of their beloved Soviet Union. The remarkable material accomplishments of a market system could no longer be denied. Liberals had completely failed to ever marshal one serious response to communism. In Reagan's victory lay the left's defeat. Only after appreciating how defeated the Democratic Party was does their defense of Clinton finally make sense. Bill Clinton was liberalism's last gasp. Republicans had just vanquished the gravest threat to freedom since Hitler, with liberals bleeding throughout. After a triumphant 12-year Republican reign, the Democrats had finally tricked the American people into putting the smarmy son of a traveling salesman into the White House on a plurality vote. From the moment they first laid eyes on Clinton, Republicans had screamed that he was a liar. And then it turned out they were right about that, too. If, once again, Republicans had been proved right, the Democratic Party would have become the functional equivalent of the Tories in Canada. The zeitgeist would have been overwhelming. Democrats could not allow Republicans to be vindicated again. At a strategic moment in history, Democrats had no choice but to defend Clinton with everything they had. For a party that had defended Stalin, this wasn't such a bitter pill. The phony protestations about Clinton's behavior at the beginning of the Lewinsky scandal were frauds from the outset. The Washington Post and the New York Times had to fake indignation in order to lull the American people into believing liberals have scruples. If they had tried to defend Clinton in the initial shock of the scandal, liberals would have lost all credibility. The unbearable facts would have to be buried under a mountain of calumnies. As with all liberal behavior tropes, you could tell what they were up to by what they accused conservatives of. Liberals can't help projecting their own malevolence onto others. The spontaneous and genuine outrage at Clinton was written off as the work of a conspiracy. The media pretended to search desperately for clues. Who was the leader of this vast right-wing conspiracy? Was it Lucianne Goldberg? Richard Mellon Scaife? The Federalist Society? Liberals waged a conscious conspiracy directed from the White House and then acted as if conservatives were part of a conspiracy. The tactics once used to prop up Soviet spies were later deployed to save a cheap flim-flam artist. Threatened with ultimate defeat, the Democratic Party would stay in the game through massive all-out counterattacks. In a speech at Notre Dame the first year of his presidency, Reagan told the students that someday their hour would come to explain to another generation the meaning of the past and thereby hold out to them the promise of the future. Liberals wrote the history of the Hiss-Chambers battle, and it took 40 years to prove Chambers was telling the truth. Liberals wrote the history of McCarthyism, and now no one knows that McCarthy was right. Liberals wrote the history of Watergate, and consequently, no one has the first idea what that even was. Already, liberals are trying to rewrite the history of the Cold War, to remove Reagan from its core, to make him a doddering B-movie actor who happened to be standing there when the Soviet Union imploded. They have the media, the universities, the textbooks. We have ourselves. We are the witnesses. Chapter 11. Neville Chamberlain had his reasons, too. While the form of treachery varies slightly from case to case, liberals always manage to take the position that most undermines American security. Demonstrating their commitment to the war on terrorism, liberals strenuously opposed America doing anything to prevent terrorism. There was no real organization to the Democrats' arguments against opposing Saddam Hussein, but a lot of hot indignation. Liberals demanded endless inspections and dialogue and yet more UN resolutions. They confidently asserted that Hussein was not an imminent threat, but then said we couldn't attack because he might use weapons of mass destruction against our troops. They would try the preemptive action argument for a while and then drop that and insist with real earnestness that we work through the Allies. Then they'd forget about the Allies and say we should be attacking Saudi Arabia. They stamped their feet demanding discussion, and then they had nothing in particular to discuss except to say that, of course, Saddam Hussein is detestable, but why didn't George Bush sign Kyoto? And then after 1 year of all their blather, liberals complained we were rushing to war. For purposes of artful dodging, liberals would always insist that of course Saddam was despicable and must go, just not yet. Liberals are masters at simulating agreement with normal people when they believe just the opposite. I disagree with the American people, but you can't catch me. Liberal sophistry required pretending they supported America's winning the war on terrorism, and before that, winning the Cold War. They just have a different plan for action. Fascinatingly, liberal proposals for achieving the goals, about which, of course, we all agree, are invariably the opposite of what any normal person might think would work. Instead of punishing bad behavior and rewarding good behavior, liberals often feel it is the better part of valor to reward bad behavior and punish good behavior. Of course, we all agree that Fidel Castro is a bad man. That's why we need to lift travel restrictions and trade with Cuba. Of course, everyone would like to see Saddam Hussein removed from power. That's why we must not do anything to remove him from power. Only in the case of smoking do liberals enthusiastically embrace the otherwise mystifying concept of punishing bad behavior. The "of course we all agree" hedge at least proves that liberals are under no illusions about the popularity of what they really believe. Both living former Democratic presidents, as well as the man liberals thought should be president, Al Gore, strenuously argued against invading Iraq. Former President Jimmy Carter said even if the U.S. produced compelling evidence that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, this will not indicate any real or proximate threat by Iraq to the United States or to our allies. After a decade of Iraq's ignoring U.N. Security Council resolutions and lying to weapons inspectors, Carter urged that we stick with U.N. inspectors. Gore said that all Americans should acknowledge that Iraq does indeed pose a serious threat to the stability of the Persian Gulf region. But before invading Iraq, Gore said we needed to establish peace in the Middle East, create a perfect Jeffersonian democracy in Afghanistan, and get the American-hating French and Germans on board. Also cure baldness and put a man on Mars. Then the time would be ripe for a preemptive attack. Unless liberals could find something in outer space that demanded our attention. To show we really meant business, Gore said we should not get sidetracked by a madman developing weapons of mass destruction who threatened his neighbors and once tried to assassinate the President of the United States. Rather, Gore said the U.S. military should spend the next 20 years sifting through rubble in Tora Bora until they produce Osama bin Laden's DNA. I do not believe that we should allow ourselves to be distracted from this urgent task, he said, simply because it is proving to be more difficult and lengthy than predicted. Al Gore wanted to put the war on terrorism in a lockbox. Democrats made a big point of opposing every anti-terrorism initiative, on the grounds that Bush should be single-mindedly focused on capturing Osama bin Laden. The Democrats' infantile obsession with Osama bin Laden, to the exclusion of all other Islamic terrorism, allowed them to sound like hawks while opposing every aspect of the war on terrorism. These were perilous times for the Democrats. What excuse would they use to oppose the war on terrorism after Osama bin Laden was captured? If America's entire national defense effort came down to the capture of one man, then the only justification for war was a connection to Osama bin Laden. For this, they said, there was no evidence. The New York Times assured its readers that there is no reliable evidence that Saddam is connected to the September 11th attack or to Al-Qaeda, and opposed war with Iraq until a future link between Iraq and terrorism could be established. The Times also cheerfully announced that there was no evidence, so far, that Baghdad means to share its deadly arsenal with others. So the only guy with the deadly arsenal was a madman who gassed his own people, murdered his family members, and passionately yearned for the total annihilation of the United States. Well, that's a relief. Days before the Times' Surrender Now editorial ran, Qadir Hamza, a former member of Iraq's weapons-building program, told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Saddam was actively developing weapons of mass destruction and would have accumulated enough enriched uranium to have 3 nuclear bombs by the year 2005. The New York Times dealt with this information by not reporting it. Apparently, it would take a mushroom cloud over Manhattan and Washington to satisfy the exacting threshold of evidence demanded at the Baghdad Times. ABC's World News Tonight ran a breathless report titled, "Reality Check: No Evidence Whatsoever of Iraq-Al-Qaeda Connection." On National Public Radio, John Mersheimer, a University of Chicago professor, said Bush had not been able to provide credible evidence that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein are joined at the hip. Is that what liberals were waiting for? No evidence became the Democrats' battle cry. It was used as often as the impeachment-era phrase, does not rise to the level of. The former director of the CIA, James Woolsey, was sent by the U.S. government to England soon after 9/11 to investigate any connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda's terrorist attacks on the U.S. Woolsey concluded the evidence was about as clear as these things get. Amid a raft of disclaimers, ABC's Nightline interviewed 2 Iraqis imprisoned by the Kurds, both of whom asserted that there was a working relationship between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Liberals also denounced Bush for staging a preemptive attack against Iraq. The New York Times, Europe's best newspaper, was in a panic over the shocking Bush policy of deploying American troops in order to protect American interests. The only just wars, liberals believe, are those in which the United States has no stake. Thus, the Times and various McTimes across the nation kept touting the idea that invading Iraq only to produce a regime change was unjustifiable, contrary to international law, and a grievous affront to the peace-loving Europeans. Gore claimed Bush was proclaiming a new, uniquely American right to preemptively attack whomever he may deem represents a potential future threat. He warned the apprehensions in the rest of the world were not calmed down any by this doctrine of preemption that they are now asserting. Once Gore hit the tuning fork, all the Democrats started vibrating in harmony. Giving a speech in London, Clinton said, "A preemptive action today, however justified, may come back with unwelcome consequences in the future." Senator Tom Daschle worried about the message it would send to the rest of the world, saying to act in a preemptive manner would be a terrible tragedy and set all the wrong precedents and send the wrong messages to the world community. What message would that be? That the U.S. will act decisively to prevent rogue nations from developing nuclear weapons? Isn't that the message we were trying to send? It's clear why America's enemies wouldn't care for that message, but why would any American be against it? The idea that America would be transgressing the laws of man and God by invading Iraq, unless and until Saddam nukes Manhattan, was absurd. Did no one remember Clinton's misadventure in the Balkans? Liberals loved that war, because Slobodan Milosevic posed no conceivable threat to the United States. To the contrary, as President Clinton put it, this is America at its best. We seek no territorial gain. We seek no political advantage. Deposing Milosevic, Clinton explained, vindicated no national interest, but was urgent because it was akin to stopping a hate crime. One searched in vain for a description of some American interest in the Balkans. Instead of droning on about human dignity and human rights, why shouldn't American foreign policy be based on the national interest? When did self-defense become a less respectable cause for war than liberation of oppressed peoples? As it turned out, the Democrats were overhasty in their use of the word genocide in connection with Milosevic. Clinton's defense secretary, William Cohen, estimated that 100,000 Albanian civilians may have been murdered. In the end, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia found fewer than 3,000 bodies, most of them men of military age. That doesn't make Milosevic a hero, but he's a piker compared to Saddam, who gassed tens of thousands of his own people and God knows how many enemy troops. So it's especially striking that liberals opposed a war with Iraq, despite Saddam's far more impressive credentials as a mass murderer. For the record, there was no UN Security Council approval for Clinton's unprovoked attack on the Serbs. If they were enthusiastic about deposing Milosevic, liberals should have been burning with desire to take out Saddam Hussein. But they were not. Deposing Saddam was in the self-interest of the United States. Only a war that serves no national interest gets the New York Times endorsement. The left's counterintuitive national security positions are always backed up with long, complicated explanations about the dire risk of encouraging hardliners, inciting the enemy's paranoia, or annoying what are comically known as the Allies. The arguments not only make no sense ab initio, but openly contradict one another. Though the Democrats would later decide for their defeatist objectives that Saddam Hussein was irrelevant to the war on terrorism, immediately after the terrorist attack, they began complaining that former President Bush had not finished off the job with Saddam Hussein in the 1991 Gulf War. The Democrats had opposed starting that war, much less finishing it. 48 Democrats in the Senate voted against the Gulf War. Clinton's Secretary of State Madeleine Albright opposed the 1991 war with Iraq, but a decade later, she too was carping about the first Bush administration, not finishing the job she didn't want to start. A New York Times editorial urged patient suasion with the harmless and misunderstood Saddam Hussein and said that every available diplomatic option must be exhausted. In the breezy style the Times uses for all its crackpot ideas, it explained that America need only ensure that Iraq is disarmed of all unconventional weapons. Meanwhile, the same editorial warned against invading Iraq on the grounds that there may be no way to deter Iraq from using unconventional weapons against American forces. Weren't we easily disarming Saddam of unconventional weapons a couple paragraphs back in that editorial? Liberals said we didn't have to worry if Saddam got nuclear weapons because he was a reasonable man. He would never use them, they assured us, because he knows the U.S. would destroy him. We could just disarm him, but that wouldn't be fair. That wouldn't even give him a sporting chance to build a nuclear weapon. Liberals longed to create a nuclear standoff with a madman feverishly developing weapons of mass destruction who gassed his own people and watched torture videos for fun. On the basis of how liberals reacted to mutually assured destruction with the Soviet Union, Americans should have been terrified that they were recommending it again with Iraq. Mad was bad enough with the Soviet Union, but there was a certain illiterate logic to it. Most obviously, the Soviet Union already had nuclear weapons. Saddam Hussein didn't. Why did liberals want to let him get there? With Iraq, we had a chance to avoid a nuclear standoff with a totalitarian despot and avoid the insane stasis of mutually assured destruction. But liberals counseled restraint. So what if Saddam eventually gets control of half the world's oil? That would be a fitting punishment for the U.S.'s rejection of the Kyoto Treaty. Liberals didn't want to talk about what would happen if Saddam acquired nuclear weapons, but kept claiming they did want to talk about something before invading Iraq. They said they wanted more discussion, and they had lots and lots of questions. The insistent demand for more discussion about Iraq tended to leave the impression that these Democrats had something on their minds. But they never had anything to say, except that we needed more discussion. After liberals had nearly tired themselves out discussing the need for more discussion, on October 7, 2002, the President of the United States gave a speech on the precise topic they all claimed to be burning with desire to discuss. Fox was the only broadcast network to cover it. ABC, NBC, and CBS did not cover the President's speech. According to the New York Times, the major networks did not run Bush's speech because the administration did not expressly ask them to. And thus ended the "we need more discussion" argument. In an amazing ruse, the left simultaneously blamed Israel and used Israel as an excuse not to take out Saddam Hussein. While secretly yearning for the extermination of Israel, liberals demanded that Bush resolve the Israel-Palestinian crisis first. Before taking out a madman developing nuclear weapons, liberals said Bush would have to solve a problem that hadn't been solved in 50 years. Of course, if Iraq ever developed a nuclear bomb, the first victim would be an imperiled civil society of Jews. One way to get Yasser Arafat back to the bargaining table would have been to take out Saddam Hussein and eliminate a principal funding source for Palestinian terrorism. But the Israel-Palestinian problem had to be solved first. When none of their other arguments worked, liberals would trot out their demands for multilateralism and UNism and working with the Allies. The left's theory of a just war had evolved to, first, military force must never be deployed in America's self-interest, and second, we must first receive approval from the Europeans, especially the Germans. Good thing we didn't have that rule in 1941. Former CBS newsman and president of the Ho Chi Minh Admiration Society, Walter Cronkite, considered it axiomatic that the United States would subject its survival to a veto by the United Nations. It is, I hope, he said, the intention of the United States to take the matter to the United Nations and work with the United Nations. Peculiarly, Cronkite insisted upon agreement from the other Arab nations. In the sort of meaningless pontification that enthralls Martha's Vineyard matrons, Cronkite said that without the support of other Arab nations, we might win a war and never establish a peace again with those people. In December 2001, Senator Tom Daschle, too, was demanding approval from the Arab allies. Of course, it would be better if the U.S. never had to go to war without lots of powerful allies. It would be better if we could have precisely calibrated Saddam's progress to acquiring nuclear arms. It would also have been better if, instead of greeting the Wehrmacht with open arms, the French had fought back. It would have been better. Be it so. We don't choose the circumstances in which we must exhibit our will as a nation. This is the price of manhood. Acting when you must and not complaining that someone might get hurt. Liberals recognized that the anti-American crowd within the country was not strong enough, so they literally had to go to Europe to get extraterritorial votes for appeasement. Americans were solidly behind the president in fighting terrorism, so liberals went and sulked with their cheese-tasting friends. The demand for support from the Allies was a classic political move. Expand the electorate to include your political allies. Public opinion in Europe was strongly against the U.S. Of course, public opinion in Europe was also for pogroms. Liberals were pimping for the most despicable people in Europe, demanding that these moral paragons be given a vote on America's national defense. The concept of allies had become rather elastic. We certainly didn't need countries like France for their military contributions. The Warsaw Ghetto held off the Nazis almost as long as did the entire nation of France. Still, Democrats were insistent that America had to give the Vichy government a veto over U.S. foreign policy. We had Britain, Australia, Spain, Italy, the Czech Republic, Turkey, and Romania, and dozens of others on our side. How many countries did we need? France and Germany. Only then would it be a multilateral coalition. Back in December 1998, when Clinton needed to bomb Iraq to delay his impeachment, Democrats weren't particularly worried about what the Allies would think. Tom Daschle said, "This is a time to send Saddam Hussein as clear a message as we know how to send, that we will not tolerate the broken promises and the tremendous acceleration of development of weapons that we've seen time and time again in Iraq." Madeleine Albright opposed war with Iraq in 1991 and 2003, but she was solidly behind Clinton's impeachment bombing of Iraq, saying, "Month after month, we have given Iraq chance after chance to move from confrontation to cooperation, and we have explored and exhausted every diplomatic action. We will see now whether force can persuade Iraq's misguided leaders to reverse course and to accept at long last the need to abide by the rule of law and the will of the world." Only when we had a president who wanted to attack Iraq for purposes of national security rather than his own self-interest did Democrats think he was being rash. Democrats are always hawks in the off-season. Fortunately, Americans disagreed with the Democrats and overwhelmingly supported war with Iraq. In the first 6 months of 2002, the ABC News Washington Post poll showed 72% supporting a U.S. invasion of Iraq. The Fox News Opinion Dynamics poll also had 72% supporting it. The Newsweek poll showed 68% in favor. It was a measure of how strong support was for war that the New York Times couldn't even produce some phony poll supporting its own evident desire to keep Saddam Hussein in power. Finally, after 9 months of the media's demoralization techniques, the Times took its first poll in September 2002, asking Americans if they supported war with Iraq. 68% supported the war, and only 24% were opposed. The headline was, "Poll finds unease on terror fight and concerns about war on Iraq." 1 month later, the Times again polled Americans on support for military action against Iraq. Again, 67% of Americans favored a U.S. invasion to depose Saddam Hussein, and only 27% were opposed. An editorial about the poll the next day was titled, "A Nation Wary of War." The Times characterized a poll that showed 67% of Americans in favor of attacking Iraq as showing the country was reluctant to go to war and uncertain how best to deal with Iraq. That's if you don't count the two-thirds who wanted to attack. When liberals get a poll result they like, they instantly seize on it to demand that the entire country move on. But when they get a poll they don't like, it means we need to have a national discussion. 67%. Do we have to have 100% approval before taking action to eliminate a threat to America's security? Of course, it was impossible to have 100% support for defending America, because some Americans are liberals. Journalists in particular simply could not make a psychological connection between America's defeat and their dying. National Public Radio reporter Nina Totenberg described Saddam Hussein as merely a personal foe of the president. Of Bush's focus on Saddam Hussein, she said, "Maybe one ought not pick one's targets based, at least in part, on who tried to kill one's dad." There were other subtle hints that the media were not keen on America. The New York Times was in a rapture when it discovered that 9 days after September 11th, Fox News chairman Roger Ailes had sent a letter to the Bush White House recommending we get rough with the terrorists. This was an even bigger scandal than Enron. A highly placed member of the news establishment wanted America to win the war on terrorism. As far as the Times was concerned, Ailes' recommendation that harsh measures be taken against the terrorists was the smoking gun of partisanship. The paper railed that Ailes purports to be an unbiased journalist, not a conservative spokesman. Fox is a self-proclaimed fair and balanced news channel. But now the Times had caught him red-handed pursuing an undisguised ideological agenda. Ailes was rooting for America. It's so obvious that liberals root against their own country that it didn't even occur to anyone at the Times that its attack on Ailes' partisanship had given up the ghost on their faux patriotism. At least we finally had it from the horse's mouth. Even for a naturally gaseous body, Democrats in Congress outdid themselves with their palaver about Iraq. Unlike the typical liberal cocktail party pedant, members of Congress would have to vote on Iraq and then run for re-election. After spending the summer of 2002 yapping about how Bush had to consult Congress before invading Iraq, when Bush went to Congress for a war resolution, the Democrats got huffy at Bush for consulting them. Democrats were chafing at having to pretend they supported America, which they did not. But they didn't want to have to say so until after the November elections. Democrats didn't think it was too close to an election to be switching Senate candidates in New Jersey, but it was definitely too close for a vote on Iraq. On Meet the Press, Senator Hillary Clinton objected to having to vote on a war resolution before the election, saying, "I don't know that we want to put it in a political context." Yes, it would be an insult for politicians to have to inform the voters how they stand on important national security issues before an election. Minority Whip Nancy Pelosi, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said the Democrats would not have enough information to make an informed decision on Iraq until January. Even the press laughed at that one. Senator Bob Byrd tut-tutted the need for a resolution on Iraq, saying September 11th was over a year old. What's the big hurry? Why is it so imminent? Why here and now? Why before the election? But back on August 30th, 2002, Senator Byrd was denouncing Bush for allegedly bypassing Congress before taking action against Iraq. "Congress needs to act and vote," he said. "There needs to be a vote in Congress." Byrd said he had contacted constitutional scholars, recognized constitutional scholars, and everyone, to the man and woman, said the president was required to ask Congress for permission and to get authorization, new authorization, to invade Iraq. the vain ranting windbag of a kleptocrat, said Bush should stop reading polls and read this, the Constitution of the United States. In addition to the indignity of having to vote on a national security issue in an election year, Byrd said the resolution on Iraq was diverting attention from the big issues. Imminent military action to remove a despot who longed for a mushroom cloud over the nation's capital was crowding out the big stuff, like naming another building in West Virginia after Bob Byrd. It was openly acknowledged that Democrats opposed the war resolution, but the politics would force many of them to fake support for war with Iraq. As CNN's Judy Woodruff said to Senator Teddy Kennedy, some Democrats are privately saying they are supporting the president because they think it will hurt them politically if they go up against the president on this. They'll look unpatriotic. Kennedy agreed, saying there was nothing terribly unusual about politicians voting their own political interests. Peter Beinart of the New Republic said the Democrats in Congress were terrified politically. He said many would vote for a war resolution in the end, but that in their heart of hearts, I think a lot of Democrats are opposed, but they don't have the intellectual self-confidence to actually come out and say so. Indeed, liberals were constantly admitting that it was the Democrat position to root against America. The New York Times reported, Democratic congressmen who are visiting Iraq this week stirred up anger among some Republicans when they questioned the reasons President Bush has used to justify possible military action against Iraq. Only some Republicans were annoyed? Weren't any Democrats the tiniest bit irritated that members of Congress were meeting with a tyrant as the U.S. prepared to attack him? It is simply axiomatic that only Republicans would be irritated by treason. The raison d'etre of the Democratic Party demands the anti-war position. In a sea of umbrellas, they said they were for peace in our time. In the final vote, Republicans overwhelmingly supported the war resolution against Iraq. In the Senate, 48 Republicans voted for the resolution and only one voted against, Senator Lincoln Chafee. In the House, the vote was similarly lopsided, Republicans supporting the war by 215-6. House Democrats overwhelmingly opposed the Iraq resolution, voting 126-81 against. In the Senate, where 100% of the members expect to be president someday, the Democrats were split, with a slight majority voting in favor, 29-21. The Democratic Party simply could not rouse itself to battle. But don't call them unpatriotic. That makes them testy. Democrats believe they should be allowed to attack Bush relentlessly on foreign policy, but that it's outrageous for anyone to mention their stand on foreign policy. Gore said Bush's foreign policy will damage our ability to win the war on terrorism and will weaken our ability to lead the world. Democrats are free to say that a Republican president's foreign policy is bad for the country, but if Republicans say the same thing about Democrats, all hell breaks loose. Then-House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt bitterly criticized Vice President Dick Cheney for saying that our nation's security efforts would be stronger if a Republican candidate for Congress were elected. Well, wouldn't it? When Senate Democrats refused to pass a Homeland Security bill, unless it included the standard federal government proviso prohibiting incompetent workers from being fired, President Bush criticized the Democrats, saying they were more interested in special interests in Washington and not interested in the security of the American people. This was absolutely factually correct. The Democrats wanted the standard civil service protections, special interests, to trump having competent workers at the Homeland Security Department, the security of the American people. Looking like an angry squirrel, then-Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle marched to the Senate floor and passionately denounced George Bush for the indisputably true statement. You tell those who fought in Vietnam and World War II they're not interested in the security of the American people. That is outrageous. That is outrageous. Democrats were beside themselves with indignation when they heard Karl Rove plan to raise the Republicans' demonstrable superiority on national security as a campaign issue. Inasmuch as vast majorities of Americans consistently rank Republicans as better on national defense, Rove evidently believed this was an argument that would resonate with voters. At least when Republicans politicize the war, you know which side they're on. Republicans were for war with Iraq. The Democrats pretended to support the war before the November elections, but then instantly started in with their Neville Chamberlain foot-dragging. Democratic presidential candidate Senator John Kerry voted for the war and then gave a major policy address months later saying, Mr. President, do not rush to war. Rush to war? We'd been talking about that war for over a year, and it had been 3 months since Kerry duly recorded his vote in favor of the war. Kerry explained his vote in favor of the war, saying he thought a resolution authorizing the president to use force against Iraq meant that the United Nations would have to approve. Senator Dianne Feinstein said she voted for the resolution, assuming it meant we would only invade if our allies approved. Senator Joe Biden made the terrific argument that if we didn't wait for UN approval, it would make a mockery of the efficacy of the UN. Perhaps the UN should have been more worried about that than we should. Senator Hillary Clinton voted in favor of the war resolution and never had another kind word to say for the war. These Democrats wanted to have it both ways. If the war went well, a lot of them voted for war with Iraq, didn't they? But if the war did not go well, many of the very Democrats who voted for the war resolution soon emerged as leading spokesmen for the anti-war position. Aren't we entitled to ask, did the Democrats support the war or didn't they? Primarily, the Democrats thought the important thing was to figure out why foreigners hate us. Gore said America will only create more enemies if what we represent to the world is an empire. We must mollify angry fanatics who seek our destruction, because otherwise they might get mad and seek our destruction. Stewing over the profound and troubling change in the attitude of the German electorate toward the United States, Gore ruefully said that the German-American relationship was in a dire crisis. Alas, the Germans hated us. That same night, James Carville read from the identical talking points on CNN's Crossfire. He said, "The Koreans hate us. Now the Germans. You know, that's one against Germany. You know what? You know what? If we had a foreign policy that tried to get people to like us, as opposed to irritating everybody in the damn world, it would be a lot better thing. Perhaps we could get Djibouti to like us if we legalized clitorectomies for little girls." According to New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, the root cause of the world's hatred for America was Kyoto. The unilateralist message the Bush team sent from its first day in office, get rid of the Kyoto Climate Treaty, forget the biological treaty, forget arms control, and if the world doesn't like it, that's tough, has now come back to haunt us. Senator Dianne Feinstein said that she was wearing an American flag pin on a trip to Europe, but the anti-American feeling was so strong, I was embarrassed to wear it. Democrats couldn't care less if people in Indiana hate them. But Europeans sneer at them, and they can't look themselves in the mirror. If they were worried about the Europeans, liberals were in a clinical depression over what the terrorists thought of us. Liberals instinctively responded to the attack of 9/11 by imputing their own hatred of America to camel-riding nomads. The nation had been attacked on its own shores, women widowed, children orphaned, thousands of our fellow countrymen killed. Liberals saw this as an occasion to ask, why do they hate us? Bill Clinton, the man who deployed the best fighting force on the globe to build urinals in Bosnia, actually said of Muslim terrorists, they have good reason to hate us. After all, we sent the Crusaders to try and conquer them. They have long memories, these fascists. As I recall, the Crusades ended in 1290. We're really sorry that 700 years ago, a bunch of Europeans responded aggressively to the sack of Jerusalem by a mob of Muslim savages. The Muslims weren't exactly shrinking violets. They had spent the prior several hundred years grabbing a lot of territory that wasn't theirs. Perhaps the Europeans were still smarting over the Muslim onslaught at Tours 400 years earlier. But okay, let's stipulate. We were wrong, and you were right. There is no grudge worth holding for 700 years. Liberals think war is a miscongeniality contest. One could mine every war-making text throughout history. Sun Tzu, Carl von Clausewitz, Alfred Thayer Mahan, without finding a single reference to being liked by your enemies as a tactic associated with winning a war. Gore said Bush had made the rest of the world angry at us. Boo-hoo-hoo. He said foreigners are not worried about what the terrorist networks are going to do, but about what we're going to do. Good. They should be worried. They hate us. We hate them. Americans don't want to make Islamic fanatics love us. We want to make them die. There's nothing like horrendous physical pain to quell angry fanatics. So sorry they're angry. Wait till they see American anger. Japanese kamikaze pilots hated us once, too. A couple of well-aimed nuclear weapons got their attention. Now they are gentle little lambs. America is fighting for its survival, and the Democrats are obsessing over why barbarians hate us. Instead of wondering why foreigners hate Americans, a more fruitful inquiry for the Democrats might be to ask why Americans are beginning to hate Democrats. Chapter 12. North Korea, another opportunity for surrender. The Democrats' approach to national security consists of a series of incoherent jibes that add up to a totally contradictory account. Conservatives are devastatingly clear, consistent, and logical, while liberals are whirling dervishes of inconsistent positions. There are few more riveting examples of this than the left's palaver about North Korea. When President Bush included North Korea in his axis of evil, liberals explained he was a moron. On the basis of years of scholarship and close study, the foreign policy experts pointed out that Iran, Iraq, and North Korea were, I quote, different countries. Tony Kordsman, an expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said, these are three very different countries here. USA Today said, an axis? Hardly. The countries have more differences than similarities. Robert Scheer wrote in the Los Angeles Times that Bush had grouped the disparate regimes of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as an axis of evil, but no such axis exists. The axis of appeasement had seized on an alternative definition of axis, colluding co-conspirators, to engage in semantic nitpicking. The country was at war, and we got word games from liberals. Of course, North Korea was not all sunshine and song. But the real danger, as liberals saw it, was Bush's evident inability to grasp that these were different countries. Former President Jimmy Carter said the axis of evil term was overly simplistic and counterproductive. Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, said, we know that North Korea is dangerous, but lumping those three countries together is dangerous. Soon the whole chorus was singing the same tune. Interestingly, however, while stressing the texture and nuance of the point that these are different countries, the left's plan for action with all three was identical. Be nice. Otherwise, we might upset them. The experts were in a panic that Bush's harsh words might compromise the path-breaking peace deal negotiated by President Clinton in 1994. The Clinton administration was in the middle of negotiating with North Korea when suddenly Carter popped up in Pyongyang, where he was meeting with the then ruler, Kim Il-sung. Before Clinton could figure out what this idiot was doing in North Korea, Carter began issuing paeans to Kim Il-sung. Like a giddy girl meeting Brad Pitt, he pronounced the crazy despot vigorous, alert, intelligent, and remarkably familiar with the technical issues. He said Kim was very deeply interested in Christianity. Carter is such a profoundly irritating person, he even got on Clinton's nerves. In case the pot-smoking draft dodger couldn't compromise America's national security interests on his own, Carter was there to help. With assistance from the architect of the Iranian hostage crisis, Clinton got this great deal for America. North Korea would get 500,000 tons of fuel oil annually and $4 billion to construct a pair of nuclear reactors for electricity. And in exchange, North Korea promised not to build nuclear weapons. In what is always a prelude to disaster, The New York Times was exultant. A 1994 editorial called the deal a resounding triumph that had brought an end to 2 years of international anxiety and put to rest widespread fears. The Times cited the soon-to-be-broken pact as an object lesson on the virtues of appeasement, jubilantly proclaiming that Clinton had defied impatient hawks and other skeptics who accused the Clinton administration of gullibility and urged swifter, stronger action. Jimmy Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his masterful negotiation of the 1994 deal.